So I'm Tony Marston. I'm a professor of neurology at University of Liverpool. But my history is in running research projects to try and inform decisions that are made in the NHS, doing some of the clinical trials that were mentioned earlier, as well as more recently work trying to inform day-to-day clinical decision-making and how services operate. I'm sure Keith will tell you a little bit about his background, but over the next half an hour or so, Keith and I are going to do a bit of a double act, and hopefully there'll be lots of time for questions. When I looked at the programme, I realised that Keith and I have been billed as the bad guys, I think. Keith and I are the problem. I'm sure that's not the case, but to an extent, Keith and I will be giving a bit of a reality check about what it's like working in the health service and changing things in the health service, because it's a huge organisation, and there may be a bit of naivety around what can be done and what can be achieved in what is a really short time frame for the NHS. So as clinicians, we're presented with problems and we like to fix them. So my brain works in this way. What's the problem? How can we fix it? And what we really want to do is do something that improves patient outcomes and does something about inefficiency in the health service. And of course, something that's going to improve the quality of what we're doing. And if we can't do this, I think we're wasting our time. We're involved in a construct that has little usefulness about it. We really must be doing something that's going to deliver something that is important to the public and patients within the NHS, improving outcomes and improving efficiency within the services. Clearly, we can't do that for the whole of healthcare in the Northwest Coast, and we have to focus on something. And when we put the bid together, we decided that we would focus on two broad areas. One was unplanned care, and that was a no-brainer because unplanned care is in the news all the time as a problem. Our emergency departments are really struggling to cope with demand. But emergency care is massive, and we need to focus on specific pathways to work on. And when we thought about this, we thought that we need to be thinking about conditions where there is interaction between multiple care providers, so the emergency departments, hospital clinics, and general practice, for example. And it kind of made sense to be thinking about chronic diseases. So can we improve the management of chronic diseases such that there is reduced load? There's less chance that people are going to end up in the emergency department. We have some early wins around epilepsy, and I'll talk about that later because of some ongoing work which we can immediately add value to through connected health cities. Chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, which is what COPD stands for, is a big problem in the Northwest Coast, and it made sense to try and pick that big ticket item to try and improve outcomes and health service efficiency. The other area that we decided to work on was upon alcohol. Alcohol, again, a massive problem in the Northwest Coast. And we need to do something to improve outcomes and access to services. And the way that alcohol affects individuals means that there's an opportunity there to bring in a really wide set of data sets, and including health, social care. And Keith will tell you a lot more about that during his part of this session. Keith and I and others have produced a kind of outline of what it is that we want to do over the next couple of years, and there are three main steps. And I'm just going to tell you about the first step, and Keith will introduce the second and the third step during his talk. What we want to do, first of all, is use data that is potentially readily available, and of course we're heavily dependent upon other bits of connected health cities to get access to the data, particularly through the team at Ames. What we want to do is start with something called hospital episode statistics, and we want to link that to other data sets such as GP prescribing and investigation results. So blood test results, scan results, can we work towards linking just these three main areas, although it's likely that our first steps are going to be made purely based upon hospital episode statistics data. John Ainsworth highlighted what a learning health system looks like. This is how we've envisaged it, so I'm going to show you a cycle that is very similar to the cycle that that John showed you. If I press the right buttons. Or it's, okay. I'm going in reverse. Am I pointing it in the right direction? There we go. Okay, right, I was pointing it at the floor rather than at the receiver. What's fundamental is that we're able to engage the clinical community. And my guess is there aren't many clinicians here. And so we have a completely different audience to engage with to try and make this work. And if we're going to do something that's going to be useful within the health service, clearly we need to be engaging with clinical communities. And Keith and I and Mike and others have got a major job on our hands to try and engage with our clinical partners to enthuse them about the ideas and try and make things happen. Those conversations with clinical partners, of course, will lead to the identification of problems and questions that we need to address, particularly within patient care pathways. And once we've identified those problems, we can think about how we want to analyse the data. And again, there is sometimes a clash of cultures. There are people that start with the data and say, what questions can we ask? Can we sort out with this data? I come from a very different culture. What's the question? What's the best design to answer that question? And then how do we analyze these data to answer those questions? We have to start off with sensible questions. If we start off with data and start playing with it, we end up going down all sorts of garden paths and end up doing something that's not as useful as we would like. So we really need to start with engaging with the clinical community, identifying those important questions, and using the data sensibly to answer those questions about what our services look like. Once we have those initial answers from the data, we can think about identifying things that we want to change. What are the data telling us about what things look like at the moment? What are the things that we want to change to try and improve the way that our services are delivered and accessed? Then, of course, we've got to implement those changes. And once we've implemented those changes, we go back to analyzing the outcome of those, and we end up in this kind of learning health cycle of analysing data such that we can have iterative changes within the health service. And you may say, well, that's kind of obvious, isn't it? Aren't we doing that already? And the answer is no, we're not doing this already. That this sort of thing, whilst it is obvious, isn't largely happening. I've been employed in the health service 26 years now, and I've seen lots of innovation and changes in the health service, but I've never seen any of those implemented changes assessed in a rigorous way to find out whether they were useful, whether they saved money, and whether they improved patient outcomes. There are assumptions that they do, and I'm sure that some of them have, but I'm sure that some of them have been pretty ineffective and not as useful as one would have liked. So whilst we can do randomized controlled trials to answer specific questions about drugs, we need to have this sort of model to inform how our health services evolve and to make sure that what we're doing is useful. You might also be sitting there thinking, well, that looks all rather simple to do, and the reality check is that it's not. Changing things in the health service is really difficult and really challenging, and it becomes even more difficult in times when cash is strapped, such as it is at the moment. And there are a number of risks that we need to address in this fairly simple cycle. Are clinicians interested? Can we engage with our clinicians to do this? They're working hard. And do they want to take time out to do these additional things as they're increasingly pressed by their managers? So we need to buy out clinician time to help them to engage with this process. No matter how motivated they are, they just might not have time to do it. We want to analyze data, but do we have access to the data that we want to analyze? And we have some massive challenges in terms of getting hold of a range of data sets. Hospital episode statistics data should be fairly straightforward to get, but getting access to other data, may prove increasingly challenging. One thing that I should have said is that the initial data we want to analyze is going to be at an anonymous level. So no, there'll be no patient identifiers there, so the patient data will be completely anonymous. And that has its limitations. So another route is to get patient consent so that they're potentially identifiable within data sets and ease linkage of data sets. And we've heard about the challenges with care data, care.data earlier. And of course, we might want to implement changes. And the question is, do people want to implement those changes? Do the CCGs want to pay for that change in services? And if not, then we're in trouble. So we have a number of risks in this cycle, and it's going to be really important that we engage with a range of partners to try and make this all happen. So a bit of a reality check in terms of how difficult it is. We do have some examples from the work that we've been doing around epilepsy, and this is work which maps onto something called the Northwest Coast CLARC, which is an NIHR, so National Institute for Health research-funded group working across the Northwest Coast, so we're working over the same footprint as the Northwest Coast CHC. And there's also a Neurology Vanguard that's been funded, and that should be getting up and going in over Mersey and Cheshire, which also brings in changes to services that we can add value to through Connected Health City. So it's an opportunity to get off the ground running. One of the things that we did a couple of years ago was a national audit of seizure management in hospitals. And this was a project where we collected data on 30 consecutive patients attending emergency departments from most of the emergency departments in the UK. And we have data on, from the second round, about 4,500 people attending the emergency department. What became very clear here was that there was a complete disconnection between emergency services and neurology services. So people were having seizures, quite a dramatic event, collapsing, convulsing on most for most people having the seizure. They go to the emergency department, and then they recover after a few hours, and by and large, they're sent home. And what you would automatically think is, well, okay, that person's had an emergency. They would be put in touch with somebody that can help diagnose the problem and sort it out. And what you find is that actually only half of people presenting to the emergency departments with a seizure actually get put on a pathway that gets them to see a neurologist. If you're someone with established epilepsy who's having seizures, have breakthrough seizures or difficult epilepsy, what you find is that half of those people haven't seen a specialist in the past year, and less than half of them are referred on to a specialist after they've attended the emergency department. So there's a massive disconnection between emergency departments and neurology services that we need to sort out. So to try and solve this problem, through the Mersey and Cheshire Strategic Clinical Network, we put together a pathway, pretty simple pathway, to try and make sure that patients attending the emergency department with seizures got to see a specialist. I guess this slide is just a reminder to me that it made me realize that for a number of years I've been looking down the wrong end of the telescope doing clinical trials to try and get some precision around estimates of what is the best treatment for people. But if people don't have access to a service, it doesn't matter how good you know the treatment is, if they're not getting access to a service where they might actually be given what is their best treatment. So we really, really do need to sort this out. And I think But my reflection is that our best opportunity to improve the quality of life of people with these chronic long-term conditions is not to produce magic bullets. We're not going to produce magic bullets in a reasonable time frame. It's about getting people to see the right person at the right time to maximize their health. So we embarked upon a journey of analyzing hospital episode statistics data, and this was led by Mike Pearson and the team at at Aintree, and Ruth Granger was the main analyst. So this got us looking at hospital episode statistic data to try and tell us a bit more about what was happening to people with epilepsy and seizures that were presenting to emergency departments. There are a few things about hospital episode statistics that you need to know if you don't know already. The first is that these are fairly dirty data. Okay, these are fairly dirty data. They're not desperately well validated, and their primary purpose is that they are collected for reimbursement. So hospitals demonstrate what activity they're doing so they can be paid for that activity. It's very heavily dependent upon how hospitals code those data. And hospitals will often employ relatively junior people to code data. So the case sheets, after the person's been discharged from hospital, will be read through by an individual who will try and code. And clearly there's going to be a lot of variability in the way things that are coded. What's chosen as the primary diagnosis, there's going to be variability there. Okay, so we need to understand that there are potential problems with the data. It's not just getting access to a data set. It's really clean, lovely, and we can just analyze it and everybody's happy. There's a significant risk of garbage in and garbage out. And over the past few years, I've seen a number of examples where industry partners have bought access to HES data and they've done an analysis and they think they've got the answer and sorted the problem out. That's not the case quite often. And to analyze these data, you really need to understand where the data come from and what they mean. So there's a real need to have clinical expertise involved with the team that are analyzing these data. The other thing to highlight is that the data focus mainly on process rather than outcomes. So they can tell you what was done, when it was done, but there aren't many pieces of information that tell you what was the outcome for the patient, how healthy were they. Clearly, things like death are recorded, but the more subtle things around health are not recorded in these data sets. And it's also very clear that we need really quite complex algorithms to help us identify the right sort of people within those data sets and the right sort of outcomes within those data sets. So once you've got the data, there's actually a lot of work trying to work out what the data mean and how you process the data to make it analyzable and useful. So this is a slide which shows time to appointment after attending the emergency department, just as a flavor of the sort of thing that you might be able to do with hospital episode statistics data. And there are two bunches of graphs. There's a bunch of curves here, and these for people that were already known to neurology services. And this is a bunch of people that weren't already known to neurology services. So if you're already known to neurology services, about three to 6 months down the line, you've got about a 60% chance of being seen within the neurology service. You might say, okay, that's pretty good, fair amount of people are getting through to the neurologists, but these people probably already had an appointment. So their attendance at the emergency department probably had absolutely nothing to do with the fact that they ended up seeing a neurologist or an expert in their condition. If you weren't known to the neurology services, your chance of getting there is pretty slim, which highlights the fact that there is this complete disconnection between emergency departments and specialist services. And these are the sorts of obvious things that need to be sorted out through connected health cities, changing pathways, and we can analyze the data in this kind of way. We can do slightly more complicated analyses. We can undertake regression models, and we can find out that these people that weren't in neurology services tended to be older, more deprived, a number of factors associated with the fact that you were denied access to the service which is most likely to help you. The pathway that we put together isn't rocket science. It's all about having a paperwork, which at the moment is paper but could be electronic, whereby data are recorded, sent to a booking office so that the neurology appointment can be organised. And the way that neurology is organised in Mersey and Cheshire is that there's one provider of care. So the Walton Centre, where I work, provides all of the neurology services in Mersey and Cheshire. So it's quite simple in terms of having one node in terms of getting access to an appointment. Like most things in the health service, if you change them, there might be an initial change, but then things kind of fritter away as people get diverted by other things. And there's no doubt in my mind that these things only work if it's somebody's job to make it work. So in this project to try and make the pathway work, we've employed some nurses in three hospitals to make sure that patients get on the pathway, and our hope is that that will actually improve patient outcomes. But then we have the question, okay, we're paying extra money for this service, what value are we getting for that? Are the outcomes that we're getting worth the spend on those additional members of staff making sure that pathways happen? We've used the HES data to drill down and provide reports for individual hospitals. These are tables with lots of numbers, and I don't think I need to go through any of the numbers, but just trying to illustrate to hospitals important facts about what is going on in their organisation. In terms of lag, we need to think about that very clearly, because at the moment we have a lag of kind of 3 to 6 months in terms of data becoming available, analyzing, and then potentially sending it out to trusts. But what kind of data lag is reasonable, and what sort of time period do we need data over that is going to be most informative to the clinical community? How soon do we want to make iterative changes? Clearly, data every year is probably too long, not very useful. Data every week is probably too soon. We need to have some ideas about, well, what is a useful turnaround time for the information. But there's a huge challenge of getting data from the hospitals to the ARC and then back out to analyze the data. So there are these kind of fundamental processes that we need to really sort out. I focused on epilepsy, but what we want to do is to use these methods in these examples of alcohol and chronic obstructive pulmonary disease to improve the flow and outcome of patients. And I'm going to hand over to Keith, and I think we'll take questions after that.
Thanks, Tony. So I'm a gastroenterologist. And when I'm on call in the evenings or at weekends, we do work weekends, patients with life-threatening problems as a result of alcohol misuse are frequent attenders to our hospital. So 6% of the emergency workload of our hospital is dealing with the downside of alcohol consumption. Approximately £3 to £4 billion per year healthcare costs in dealing with alcohol misuse and the attendant health and social harms. So it's a big ticket item, as Tony's alluded to. My background is in data, and I've always thought that real data would start to trump the sort of purest ivory tower efficacy testing of randomized controlled trials, even though they're vitally important. And I think we are seeing now an ascendancy of the potential to use real world data to inform healthcare delivery, because the tools are now appearing and the potential linkages are starting to appear where we can actually legitimately think about using data delivered back with reduced latency to drive services. Now, I don't know whether this shows in terms of the lighting, but a typical patient with alcohol problems touches basically the whole variety of individual professionals and agencies. And so it's a ripe area of endeavor to try to see how data-driven solutions might at least improve pathways, because it's such a rich and diverse collection of professionals and interactions, not just the healthcare system, but of course, crime. There's non-statutory support. The voluntary sector in terms of supporting patients with alcohol is huge, both in terms of residential and day attendance provision. So a great deal of complexity here and potential for data-driven solutions. But we need to start somewhere, and we're going to start in the hospitals, because that's where we can pick the patients up, and actually where that's where much of the cost and the harm and the spending is occurring. So let's just focus on the patient presenting to the accident emergency unit with an alcohol-related problem. Well, is it as simple as that? No, it's hugely complex. We were asked repeatedly during the generation of this, of the program, what's the pathway? Well, there are a multitude of pathways associated with dealing with patients with alcohol consumption, because alcohol can produce the acute effects of intoxication, falling down in the street and bumps and scrapes and trauma. It's linked with mental health problems. If you bang your head hard enough, you'll have a serious neurosurgical event and have a life-threatening complication. You may get abdominal pain and present to casualty. You may have severe abdominal problems such as pancreatitis and be hospitalized. Different teams, different clinical problems, not one pathway. And I could go on. But DREAD is end-stage liver disease, and that's, of course, one of the big killers. So we do have resources and knowledge about how we'd like the pathways to operate. And in documents produced by NICE, for example, we know there are specific guidance and specific pathways that we would like our patients to follow. But our needs are not well addressed at the moment in terms of data to underpin adhering to some of the ideals laid out in pathways and guidance nationally. And they don't always fit the neat documentation and simplistic pathways presented in these sorts of guidance. So let's just concentrate on one particular example. This is a patient who is a long-term alcohol user. He frequently drinks. When he runs out of money, he starts getting the shakes. He wakes up in the morning and he doesn't feel too well. The following day, he doesn't remember the following day because he blacked out and he had a fit and he ended up in the emergency department. And he can't describe what happens. And he attended the hospital in a confused state. He wasn't able to provide the list of his medication or his past medical history. He had a toxic confusional state. So this is a really good example of a situation where the team attending that patient may be data poor, may want access to what happened to the patient last time, may want access to patients' clinical records from primary care, and may not have that sort of access. So potential to improve the lot of patients with these sorts of presentations. Guidance, endless guidance and standards about how we should be treating the patients, but just let's think about a simple one. A patient with symptoms of alcohol withdrawal presents to the casualty department, and the decision is, do we admit that patient or not? Now, if they have a fit, or they're obviously in delirium treatment, so they're hallucinating and lashing out at staff, then they'll be admitted. But if they have a moderate or mild version of alcohol withdrawal, what do we do with them? Do we put them back into the community? Do we give them brief intervention and send them to an inpatient voluntary sector, a detox centre? Or can they be managed as an outpatient with nursing support? And that's a really important decision. Do we admit the patient or not? And what sort of pathway should they then follow? So that's one area we can perhaps think about focusing our minds as we start the alcohol misuse pathway. But the problem is we're blind. We're navigating without a sat-nav. We don't have any feel for the proportion of patients hitting casualty with alcohol misuse. It's not captured. We don't know how many patients with the potential to be treated for alcohol detoxification we're seeing. A&E records record the patients. It's written in the notes. It's not electronic. We don't know how many patients are coming. We may get coding data for the patients admitted, but that's, of course, the numerator. We want to know the denominator. What's the population of patients? So that's the opportunity to try to start gathering data that informs NICE standards. If we want to benchmark, we need to collect the data. And so what we've planned from the University of Liverpool is to try to engage and to engage widely and starting with clinicians to start embedding clinical thought and logic into how we can best use the data we have already, how we can improve the way we collect data to make it more structured, and how we can hopefully engineer and provide opportunities for industry to provide solutions to some of the testing questions and problems we have with managing patients. So identifying problems, flagging potential solutions, and hopefully setting some priorities. And so we'll be using a model of direct observation. We'll be going into individual hospitals with a clinical fellow. We'll be following the staff and the patient around so we understand their interactions with data, their interaction with systems. Who are the people collecting data? What data are they recording? What systems are they using to record it? What are their frustrations? Why is it they don't have access to GP prescribing records? Why is that? It's ridiculous, but it's true. Why are they still writing data with manual notes? You talk about the electronic health record. It's a misnomer in many hospitals. It's a scanned version of annotated free text annotations. The sorts of questions we're interested in terms of data are simple things. What data is being recorded by the relevant staff? What's the purpose of that data? Is it to deliver care? Is it a point of care decision? Is it to decide whether to admit or not? Or is it to decide which drug to use? Or is it to make a thought about how this patient may be discharged? Is it about the background? So what's the purpose of the data we're collecting? And what are the priorities? What are the key items of data we really should be capturing electronically to improve these pathways? What's the format of the data? I've already alluded, often unstructured, often not electronic or codified. Who's collecting the data? Not just the doctors, there are administrators, there are other people in the chain collecting data that's relevant to understanding the pathways. How long does it take to collect the data? We're going to do some time and motion. How much of the time of the medical registrar, this highly paid resource, who's been on strike recently because they're concerned about working even more weekends, how much of that person's time is actually fighting the IT, trying to extract the data and the information about the patient? Because the key thing about healthcare, it's not just a data-driven solution. There are elements to healthcare professionals' working lives that have got nothing to do with data. It's the more pastoral, it's the more professional, it's the caregiving aspect of their job. And those professional skills can be better used if they're not struggling with the data, and that the data collection and retrieval becomes more efficient. And that's what we hope to do, to actually identify the frustrations of frontline staff and try to solve those problems that can be solved by data to free up their abilities to spend more time with the patient. You don't stop a patient drinking alcohol by giving them an app. Most patients who have alcohol abuse will take that phone, they will sell it, and they'll be richer in terms of their alcohol consumption. So it's not that. It's about giving the professionals the freedom to identify the patient, segment the patient, understand who they are and where they came from, what's their background, and then provide those more professional services that are not necessarily data-driven. So we are currently working in an NHS where much of data collection is like this. And the Star Trek type model of the multifunctional data collecting device with all the data plugged in and fed back. Even Kaiser Permanente, who've spent how much? £2 billion on the electronic healthcare system and records, haven't achieved this sort of utopian vision across the board. What we plan to do is profile pathways to follow patients and staff to understand the flows of data and identify with our steering group of specialists what the key items of data that are missing, what data do we have now, what would we like, what potential applications are there to improve the way data is delivered on these pathways. So, patient that I alluded to earlier has collapsed in the street with his alcohol-related seizure. The first contact he has may be the paramedics and the ambulance staff. He then gets to the front door, and the nurse will triage how serious is this problem, record some basic observation. This will start a nursing set of notes, which will probably never be married up with the medical notes, and will sit in a folder which will eventually be scanned. That's your electronic record in reality. So the nurse triage starts. The A&E team, a group of doctors, will see the patient and make some clinical decisions. They'll make a clinical assessment. They'll need access to some of the systems in the hospital to access the patient's past history and previous attendances. They'd like to have access to primary care data, but in many hospitals that won't exist or will be patchy. There may be a key individual in this chain, this pathway, the alcohol specialist nurse, and this nurse will now start to put in some protocolized specialist input to this patient. If the patient's going to be admitted, and let's hope there's admission avoidance opportunities, then the acute medical team who's on call that day will see the patient and record their notes. Often repetitive data entry, often eliciting and recording the same information manually. If the patient ends up on the ward, then another team will take over. So that's the flow, but what about the data? Well, the ambulance men record, it's a nice pro forma, but it's not electronic data. So that data, in terms of electronic record, sits as a scanned version of the document. The case notes begin as the patient starts moving through the A&E department and we record A&E clinical information. And the case notes build. There are all sorts of opportunities here. We use screening tools, we use charts and triggers for prescribing, but many of these have not been digitalized. And even if they have in an individual hospitals, they haven't across the whole coast. So there's learning and opportunity here to convert some of these manual processes into much more efficient digitized solutions with a memory, so that when the patient comes back, you can access very quickly, not only that they came in with that problem, but how they responded and what their treatment outcome was. So all sorts of potential opportunity there. There are other people in the chain, the administrators, recording when the patient first checks in, when the patient comes from one ward to another, opening and closing episodes. And the reality of data in the NHS is, as Tony's alluded to, the data we have currently for all providers that is collected in a structured electronic form, and you could analyse at any hospital, is the basic HES data. It's literally based on that electronic health record, or the word scanned set of notes, getting down to a coding department, being codified into some simple information, and combined with the administrative data. So the whole misnomer of the electronic record, there's huge potential here, but the data we have that is ubiquitous across all providers is this basic beans, and that's why we want to start with that. It's very simple. Tony's alluded to what it might contain, but these are really simple beans, and we want to improve that. And by mapping the pathways, by engaging with clinicians, we hope to identify what the key extra items of information. Do this in a targeted way. We're not going to solve the electronic health record, but if we can link a specific blood test or a specific clinical assessment tool into the pathways and start digitizing that data flow, then we can enrich what we have with our routine data. This is from the States. Fantastic investment in electronic health records. But what does staff actually put into those records? So this is a record of all singing, all dancing. Alcohol consumption is often recorded in a variety of fields in free text. There are structured fields to allow you to record that, but people don't use them. The human factors. So it's great to have a wonderful new system, but you've got to get people to understand where the data and how the data should be stored to, if you like, leverage greatest value from it subsequently. Finally, we are very keen on the engagement aspect of Connected Health Cities and a feeling, and you may have sensed it from us, that the clinical community have not been adequately engaged or have taken the time to engage in much of what is happening in terms of informatics. And that needs to change, and we need clinically driven questions, pragmatic questions, as Tony's alluded to. The simple fact that a patient's clinic appointment is not set up and arranged. This is not high tech, but it affects lives, and that's where we're at with our thinking. The routine data is often used to map, and you see lots of public health maps. This is how Liverpool is doing in terms of the league table of deaths from or admission episodes from alcoholic disease. So we thought, well, how can we bring together people, not just health workers, not just the frontline staff, but the wide agencies I've alluded to in terms of alcohol misuse, to start sharing data and understanding it in a way that makes sense to each of the individuals. And what we've come across is one possibility, which is to use maps, because maps are quite intuitive, they're quite easy to understand, and you can overlay information. So one of the projects we intend to do is to start mapping the admissions at a very small area level, so it starts to have that local feel. So when you look at this map, this is actually the Sefton footprint. This is Sefton Metropolitan Borough Council, the area that sends patients to Aintree Hospital. And each of these small areas is just about 1,600 people, about 500 houses. It's a lower super output area, really quite small. And the size of them depends on the density of the population. I don't know how well it projects, but we've just simply mapped the hot spots for alcohol admissions. But how much other data could we start overlaying on that? Not just the alcohol-related harm, and we could do that better, but what about the location of relevant services? Wouldn't it be wonderful when a patient comes to hospital, you're able to put the map up and you understand that that area is a place, A, that takes a lot of admissions, patients are often readmitted, the GP practices are struggling to cope with managing patients in the community, and there isn't a local voluntary agency, alcohol anonymous opportunity in that area. So stratified, personalised medicine through knowledge of a patient's localisation and where they actually live. So that's just one potential tool we'd like to develop to try to inform how we use data to bring together multiple agencies. And one of the things we mapped for interest, just finishing, was off-licence density. So we look at the number of admissions from a particular small area. And when you look at these areas, if you know the area, you know what the pubs are. And we mapped the density. It doesn't show very well in this lighting, but basically a huge cluster around the hotspots. Now, is it chicken or egg? But nevertheless, if you're a local council and you're dealing with licensing, is it ethical and right to put another cheap retailer into an area that is costing your local health economy X pounds? So ways to use the data perhaps to inform policy as well as decisions on the ground. So finally, we see ourselves very much as trying to identify the clinically driven problems and potential solutions. By discussing and sharing data with people, hopefully we'll start to engage with a whole raft of people who have potential solutions to some of the data blocks that we see in the healthcare system. Our data approach is starting with the NODI data, because that's all there is in reality, building up by linkage to electronic health records, and then the whole world of big data, should permissions allow, is a fantastic opportunity. Engaging clinical teams to begin with, but then wider and wider stakeholders. Ripples in the pond, engaging more widely. We know that aggregated data is what we'll be left with initially because of the anonymisation and consent issues, but we hope to move towards increasingly segmented and individualised data. And if we use that schema, then we hope to create, if you like, ideas to drive CHC forward. So this is where we are. I'm not sure we're going to get here, but hopefully the collaboration will allow us to move a nudge in that direction. Thank you.